So yeah, I'm just going to say a few things about Vajrasattva. Some of you may be very familiar with the symbol of Vajrasattva, others of you maybe not. So we often have a Vajrasattva day before Parinirvana Day, which is tomorrow. So if you would like to come to the festival tomorrow, Parinirvana Day is a day when we remember those close to us who's died. And Vajrasattva has a connection with death, which I'll talk about later. So often we precede Parinirvana Day with a day devoted to Vajrasattva. So Vajrasattva is the adamantine being. So Vajra is the diamond thunderbolt in Tibetan Buddhism. And diamond is a substance which can cut through everything and not be cut itself. So it becomes a symbol in Tibetan Buddhism, in Buddhism itself, for reality. Reality is whole, unadulterated, complete, cannot be affected. So the Vajra becomes a symbol for reality, for shunyata, for emptiness, for truth. And Vajrasattva, sattva means being. So Vajrasattva, which is the figure we have on the shrine here, is a being whose consciousness is totally pervading with truth or reality. And he's very strongly associated with purity, because truth or reality is something transcendent, something that transcends our normal thought processes, our normal emotions, all our conditions. So he's very strongly associated with purity and purification. He's also sometimes called the confounder of hell, which I'll come back to also. And he's associated with death. So he is the embodiment of purity. Vajrasattva as a symbol is the embodiment of purity. And sometimes he's called the prince of purity. So he's a slightly esoteric, enigmatic figure. He appears in Tibetan Buddhism, he doesn't appear in earlier Buddhism. And he's a Buddha who appears in Bodhisattva form. So sometimes he's referred to as the Adi Buddha. Now this is a rather mysterious quality of Vajrasattva, that he's the Adi Buddha, because the Adi Buddha is a Buddha of the sixth dimension, or another dimension entirely from the mandala of the five Buddhas, which you might be familiar with. So again, it's just symbolizing that he's completely outside time and space. He's completely from another dimension, as it were. So one can say these things, but it's really beyond the rational mind. He's a symbol in a way. You have to be open to the symbol so that the symbol speaks to you. So he's pure white in colour. I mean, we have a metal rupee here, but when he's depicted in a tanker, he's brilliantly white. And often dazzlingly white, often made of crystals. He's said to be white like the early morning sun shining upon freshly fallen snow. So that's something we've had a bit more experience of this winter, if you wake up early and there's been a snowfall. You have to get there really early, don't you, before people tread on it, it's all kind of slushy. But if you see freshly fallen snow, no one's walked on it, it's really beautiful on a beach, actually. If you're by the sea and it snows, it's very beautiful. And if it happens to be a sunny day and the sun is shining on the snow, so the sunlight is reflected off the snow. That's the kind of quality of his light. So he's made of light, he's like a crystal. And he sits on a full white lotus, a pure white lotus, and on a moon mat. So, a lot of whiteness. His long black hair, and he has a compassionate, smiling face. So he wears the five jewel crown of the five jinnas on his head, because he's the embodiment of all their wisdom. So often, if you see Tibetan Buddhist tankers and you see this mandala of the five Buddhas of the five colours, Vajrasattva is above in the centre. So he encompasses all their qualities, all their wisdoms. So he holds to his heart in his right hand, with his palm upwards, a golden Vajra, the symbol of diamond, the Vajra thunderbolt. Sometimes made of crystal, but often golden. And the Vajra, in this context, symbolises compassion or skillful means or activity in the world. And he holds his left hand by his hip, what's called the Vajra Ganta, the Vajra bell. It's a very beautiful silver bell with a Vajra handle, with a beautiful tone, which symbolises wisdom, shunyata, or emptiness. So again, he's the union of wisdom and compassion. And in his heart, again on a pure white lotus, on a pure white moon mat, is the deep blue syllable Hum. You can see the syllable Hum on these little prayer flags. So that's his seed syllable in his heart. And around the seed syllable, in a clockwise direction, with the letters upright, as it were, are the syllables of the 100-syllable mantra, his mantra. And these are often radiantly white, like moonbeams, like moonlight, like pearls, like the garland of pearls. So we can visualize him in the midst of a clear blue sky. He also appears at the top of, if you're familiar with the refuge tree, our own refuge tree, he appears in that symbol above the five jivas, but sort of just floating in the clear blue sky. So he's quite mysterious. He's sometimes referred to as the last image before the imageless. He's beyond space and time. He's completely unconditioned, beyond words and concepts, constructions, even beyond symbols, which is kind of quite hard to imagine. So he's a symbol of truth itself. He's the furthest limits of the expressible, a symbol of that which cannot be symbolized. So you can sort of, again, you can say these things, but you have to get a sense of what he's pointing to, what that symbol points to. So he symbolizes truth, reality, and therefore purity. He symbolizes the potential of the mind, our mind, to transcend all conditions, to transcend time and space. And as the Dharma, as the truth, is pure of all conditions, he symbolizes purity. And he symbolizes our own inherent, pure, unstained nature. That we, from beginningless time, are essentially pure in our deepest nature. So this is not ordinary purity. That sounds a bit like the beginning of an advert for Marks and Spencer's food, doesn't it? This is not ordinary. Marks and Spencer's. So, not ordinary purity. This is Vajrasattva purity. So you can think of purity on different levels, but he obviously symbolises transcendent purity. So it's not just physical, just moral. It's certainly not moralistic. And Banji says it's not even spiritual purity. It's not purity in the sense of something arising in dependence upon our practice. So yes, we can purify our ordinary mind. We need to purify our ordinary mind. But Vajrasattva's purity is not any purity that can be attained. We can only speak of it as primordial, primeval, the original spotless purity of our minds. Stainless, sparkling, unsoiled, untouched. So he is a symbol of something incredibly positive, very, very positive. So it can, of course, be misunderstood. I said this morning in the little introduction. We can think, perhaps, well, I'm inherently pure, and therefore what I do doesn't matter. But there's a sort of paradox involved here, because on the level of ordinary life, ordinary activities, what we do matters very, very much. Unskillful actions have unskillful consequences. Skillful actions have skillful consequences. And we know from our own experience that that is true. If we behave unskillfully, there are consequences to that. And those consequences accumulate and they affect us. They affect our states of mind. They affect our communication with others. So on the ordinary level, it's very, very important. But our actions and the effects of our actions also arise in dependence on conditions. So in that they arise in dependence on conditions. They are ultimately empty. And they don't affect our deepest Vajrasattva nature. So this is the kind of incredibly positive message of the symbol of Vajrasattva. So the analogy that we can use is like the blue sky and the clouds. And again, I talked about this a little bit this morning. So we know that there are clouds, and the clouds kind of obstruct the blue sky. Sometimes they're quite light and fluffy. Sometimes that's how our thought processes are. Sometimes the cloud cover is incredibly thick, and we can't see the blue sky at all from where we are or experience it. And you know what that's like, don't you, if you have days and days and days, if you're English, in England, of cloudy skies. It affects your mood. And you can sort of forget what a blue sky is like, what a sunny day is like. But we know if we get in an aeroplane and we rise above the clouds, that the blue sky is there. We can sort of look down on the clouds from the aeroplane. And the blue sky is pure, untouched, radiant, has always been that way, will always be that way, is it? So clouds come and go, and the sky remains the same. So in the same way, we can imagine our mind as being like the sky through which the clouds pass. So they come and go, and the sky mind remains untouched. So the clouds then are like the greed, hatred and delusion that pollute our minds. But because of the transient nature of those mental states, they cannot be said to be an inherent part of the mind. So I remember I used to live at Tiruvannamalai up in the Brecon Beacons, and it's in a valley surrounded by mountains, and you know how sometimes, and there's a stream that goes through the valley, sometimes you get sort of mist, sort of low-lying mist, and sometimes that mist is quite thick. I remember one morning it was very misty, and somebody said, oh, if we just got in the car and we drove up along the valley and up into the top of the hill, and then we got out of the car and walked up to the top of the mountain, we'd be above the clouds, why don't we do that? So we said, yeah, that's a good idea. And somebody said, oh, that won't work. It'll just be cloudy. So off we went, leaving this person behind. And it was great. You know what it's like when you kind of get through the mist and you're up on the top and then, you know, you're looking down the mist and you're completely blue sky as far as you can see. So it's a very evocative experience, isn't it? It's a very, you suddenly feel open and alive and fresh and everything's new and you feel free. So we got back down and said, well, that's really great. Mm-hmm. And this person said, oh, I wish I'd gone, I'll go now. But by the time she got there, the cloud cover was very, very thick. It didn't work for her. So there you go, act in the moment. Act on a good idea. So yes, the special purity that's symbolised by Vajrasattva is that we are by nature pure, we're untouched by anything. And Vajrasattva's purification, because it's also associated with purification, even though what he's symbolising is that things have always been pure, his purification consists in the realisation, and the waking up to this experience, the purification of thinking that we are not pure. That's his special purification. So sometimes I think we can react to the word purity. Purity. Does it fill you with excitement? Maybe not. And maybe that's to do with some aspects of our conditioning. So we can think of purity sometimes, can't we, as being naive or anemic or weak or goody-goody. It has connotations, I suppose, of innocence, childlikeness, even virginity or chastity. And I remember a Vajrasattva practitioner, a friend of mine, giving a talk on a women's convention many years ago and talking about our reactions to the word purity. And she said to us, you don't want to be white and pure, do you? You'd rather be red and wild and running around like a dakini, which I thought was quite quite true. There were murmurs of agreement in the audience. So we'd much rather be kind of a dakini figure rather than white and pure. But we come across purity quite early on in our contact with the Dharma. It's not a foreign idea to us, is it? We recite the precepts in English and we say, with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. With truthful communication, I purify my speech. With mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my mind. So you know, we're used to the idea of we need to purify body, speech and mind. And we're probably familiar with the traditional Buddhist verse, cease to do evil, learn to do good, purify the mind. So we do have associations with and connections with purity. But the precepts and that verse is about, in a way, purifying the ordinary mind. And as I've said, the purity symbolised by Vajrasattva is on another level altogether. It is this essential purity outside of time. It is an incredibly positive thing to contemplate or reflect upon, that we're not miserable sinners for all time. We can transcend, we can wake up to the truth that we are essentially pure. So yes, we have different associations with purity, and it may be that we do have associations with purity of naivety. Actually, naivety, if you look in the dictionary, is has a positive definition. It means natural, unaffected, free from deception. But I think we often think of naivety as being not very clued up, of being stupid or ignorant or easily taken advantage of or inexperienced. So, you know, those kind of associations aren't very appealing, are they? Or lacking in experience. And we can also have connotations or associations with purity and innocence. And maybe innocence also doesn't have positive a meaning for us. And maybe again we think of innocence as lacking in experience. And I think Vajrasattva's purity is a kind of innocent kind of purity. I think if we're in touch with that kind of purity, as I said, if you get up above the clouds and you're in the blue sky, there's a sense of innocence and the sense of everything is new, everything is fresh, everything is open, everything is unstained, there's no past, there's no future, you're outside of time. And this association with freshness and newness in that way means that Vajrasattva is often associated with the dawn, the light just coming, you know, the sun just breaking, the sun just rising, and how that feels if you're in a beautiful dawn. Everything's new, a new day ahead of you. So it has those kind of associations, it has positive associations as well as not so positive for us. So I remember, I've done quite a lot of Vajrasattva practice in my time, although it's not my main practice. I remember some years ago, probably actually quite a long time ago, doing quite a lot of Vajrasattva practice on a meditation retreat. And at the time, I was struggling with some very painful experiences, emotional experiences, very painful memories from my past, from my childhood, that just kept sort of, you know, coming back and coming back and turning over and turning over. And I was at Vajraloka on the retreat, and it was autumn. It was a beautiful autumn, and there are woods up there, so you know, there was beautiful sunlight shining through the autumn leaves in the woods. But I was in the shrine room and just struggling away, and suddenly, these things sometimes just happen. They just, you have a little glimpse of something. I was in my imagination in the woods, in a clearing, and the sun was shining down, so the sun was filtering through these beautiful autumn leaves. And at the same time, I could hear the sound of children playing, kind of completely innocently and freely. It was just a sort of momentary experience, but it was as though whatever was going on in my kind of painful experience, as though I touched into the innocent state of childhood, or maybe my innocence that was underneath or beyond, you know, the conditioned pain, as it were. And a very, very strong experience, just a moment actually, a very beautiful experience. And those kind of experiences often are very brief when we have them, but they're very, very nourishing, very, very nurturing. You know, they have a big effect even though they're momentary. So I think, you know, I'm not saying I touched into Vajrasattva's innate purity, but I think in a reflection of that, you know, that I wasn't completely lost cause, as it were. Some other part of me that was kind of untouched, it was open, it was innocent. So that had quite a big effect on me and my practice. And that did arise, I think, out of contemplation of Vajrasattva. So innocence can be a very positive experience. Other associations with purity. Well, Visantra talks in one of his talks on Vajrasattva about associations with purity, and he says, well, what about pure alcohol? What about comparing it with pure alcohol? Which may be an interesting idea, interesting analogy. But he says, well, if we associate purity, Vajrasattva's purity, with being anemic or goody-goody or weak, pure alcohol is unadulterated. It's not diluted, it's not mixed with anything, it's full strength, it's concentrated, it's authentic. So in a way you could say that's the kind of purity of Vajrasattva. It's unadulterated, it's not diluted by any conditioned factors. It's not mixed with anything else, it's not mixed with anything mundane. It's full strength, it's concentrated, it's authentic, it's essential. So in that sense, purity symbolises our pure, unadulterated consciousness, not diluted by any kind of mundane experience. A mind totally focused and absorbed in the contemplation and experience of reality. So then you get a sense of the kind of purity we're talking about, what Vajrasattva symbolises. It's being very, very strong, very, very powerful, and then able to be very, very transformative. So yes, Vajrasattva is the embodiment of purity, and as I've said, there's a kind of paradox, because he does embody that purity beyond time and space, and that realisation that at our deepest level we've never been impure. There's never been a moment, because there are no moments when we've been impure. But we do need to wake up to that fact. It's not enough to have a intellectual thought about that. It has to be an experience. We have to have an experience of waking up to that. And to do that, we need to create the conditions for that experience, that kind of insight, as it were, to arise. And to create those conditions, we do need to purify our ordinary consciousness, our ordinary mind, our body, speech and mind. So he both symbolises purity in that absolute aspect, and contemplating him and reciting the mantra helps to purify our mind and to overcome our alienation and separation from that purity. So there's this sense, isn't there, that there's a blue sky somewhere, or, you know, there's our own innate purity. And I suppose moment by moment now, most of us probably aren't that much in touch with that, and I can't speak for you, but, you know, we're in touch with it little by little, or sometimes and not other times. So there's a sense that we're separated from, as it were, that real experience of ourselves. We're alienated from it. We feel distant from it. And sometimes if you're not in touch with something or somebody, some aspect of yourself, or maybe some other person, some aspect of them, if you're separate or alienated or distant, sometimes that thing, as it were, becomes frightening also. Even the hostile to you. Do you understand that? Does that make sense? Yeah. So we start off perhaps not in touch and isolated and separate and maybe even a bit frightened. And that was my own experience with Vajrasattva for a long, long time. I'm a long time practitioner of the green Tara practice, so green is nice and soft and it's nature and it's nurturing. And green Tara is a very beautiful figure who's the quintessence of compassion. She's a female Bodhisattva and she's stepping towards you and she's putting her hand out and she's very, very kind, she's very, very forgiving. So that was my choice of Bodhisattva. and I just never could relate to Vajrasattva. I knew other people who did the Vajrasattva practice, but he seemed completely and utterly, I suppose, remote, or just I just didn't have any connection at all with that figure. Didn't particularly like white. Blue is absolutely not my favourite colour. I know 7 out of 10 people, blue is their favourite colour, but it's never been mine. I was used to the sort of soft green light of Tara, or rainbow coloured light which she emanates. And the sort of white light, it's really white light, like neon light, very kind of harsh and cold. So that was my associations with Vajrasattva, kind of somewhere else. And that was, it was like that for a long time. I've been in the order a long time, maybe 20 years or something. And then I was on a series of retreats, pre-ordination retreats, where we started to do the going for refuge and prostration practice of the Buddha Shakyamuni. And at the top of the refuge retreat is Vajrasattva, and I think I probably ignored him for quite a long time. and then I realised he was kind of important. And and in the refuge tree practice, white light comes down from the home of the refuge tree and also from Vajrasattva. And I remember saying to someone, I really don't like white light. Could I not make it sort of soft and golden? Could I not do that? And they said, yeah, why don't you do that, if it helps. so yes, I had this sort of sense of white light being very harsh, and it's like a neon light. And with that kind of pitiless quality, it was going to highlight every tiny fault and failing. I mean, I know that's what it's supposed to do in a way, but there's a kind way of doing that and a sort of harsh way of doing that. And I think this does come from my early Christian conditioning, that, God sits on your shoulder and can see absolutely everything and brings about irrational guilt, or it did in me. So that was my kind of association with Vajrasattva and white light. And this retreat was a month's retreat. It was quite intense. So we were doing this practice every day. And I must have begun to, through imagining soft golden light, maybe open up to the light coming from the refuge tree and the white light. And then one day, Vajrasattva in the visualization become very, very alive and very, very vivid to me. And at the same time, I hear voices in meditation. I belong to the Joan of Arc school of meditation. I hear voices. I hear this voice say, thou that takest away the sins of the world, have mercy upon us. I heard this very, very clearly, and I was in sort of shock. because I thought, God, I used to say that a lot as a child, but I hadn't said it for a very long time. I'd been Buddhist for a long time, so I hadn't said that for a very long time. It's a Christian, liturgy, isn't it? So that was kind of very strange experience, really, but odd experience. And I, over the rest of the retreat, I had a number of experiences where there was some kind of, well, initially it seemed to me like a confusion between my Christian background and my present Buddhism. Later on it seemed to me like there'd been an integration taking place, but it was quite confusing. Now, in the Vajrasattva practice itself, once you've recited the mantra and you've been purified, there is a line that says, "My daughter and my son, your sins and those of all other beings are wiped out." So there is a kind of parallel, isn't there, a connection? I had a really strong effect when I thought, am I really a Buddhist? Maybe I'm not really a Buddhist, maybe I'm just a Christian. Maybe after all this time. and I can't remember the other experiences, but I know it kind of, other things happened. And I began to think that when I was a practicing Christian, when I was young, and I was very devout for 2 or 3 years, it didn't last very long. And then I completely rejected Christianity for certain reasons, and I became a militant scientific atheist. I thought, oh, but there was probably something positive in that, though, that I've rejected. There was a kind of openness, I mean, there was a kind of innocence. I was quite young, sort of 11, 12, 13, 14. Something, you know, a desire to kind of open to something beyond myself and to sort of surrender to something positive. And I thought, oh, maybe I, you know, kind of, I shut that off. And even though, you know, I'm a practicing Buddhist and I engage in puja and I'm quite devotional, maybe there's still something kind of that hasn't come into consciousness. And so that was quite an interesting reflection. Now, I've become suspicious of something. So then I realised that I had this desire. There were some beautiful shrines in the shrine. There was a main shrine in the Taraleva shrine, and then all around the shrine we built these shrines to different Buddhism bodhisattvas. And the Vajrasattva shrine was very beautiful. I ignored it for a while. And I began to have this desire to prostrate in front of the Vajrasattva shrine. But I realised I had this desire. This is very funny. Have you seen The Thornbirds, the movie The Thornbirds? It's a very old movie. Richard Chamberlain, yes, he becomes a bishop, and he wears this lovely white frilly nightie, and he's lying in front, as they do, he's lying in front of the shrine in crucifixion position. So I remembered that. And that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to sort of lie on the floor in front of the Vajrasattva shrine like that. So again, I was a bit worried. Gosh, I'm mad. Anyway, I had good friends on the team on this retreat, one of whom was an ex-Catholic, and I said, I've just got this urge. Oh, go do it. We'll find you a white nighty and go after the puja when everybody else has gone to bed and just do it, because I'm sure it'll do something for you. It looked good. And I don't think I went that far. But I did do it, and then I realised I did want to actually prostrate in a Buddhist sense to Vajrasattva. So I did have a feeling that something very important was integrated during that retreat. A kind of integration happened. And then, of course, I realised that the white light of Vajrasattva was actually the white light, you know, the golden light, was actually very, very soft and very, very beautiful and very, very kind and very healing and very refreshing. So, you know, I began to realise that it wasn't the way I thought it was. A sort of kindness. So after that, I suppose I had such strong experiences. I did take up the visualisation and mantra recitation of Vajrasattva for many, many years, as well as doing the Tara practice. And I still do the practice from time to time. So I think it kind of integrated something from my Christian past, and it did actually purify something. It purified my misconceptions about purity, I think, and about what white light was and what purification was and irrational guilt and so on. So it's just a little story to point out that I think reflecting on Vajrasattva and chanting his mantra can have a very strong effect on us. We don't know what that effect is going to be or what's going to happen. So say something about the mantra itself, because one of the main parts of the practice is reciting the mantra, and we've been doing that this morning. We've done four rounds of 21 Vajrasattva mantras this morning, so that's a very strong experience. So going back to this sense of initially feeling separate or isolated or not connected with one's inner depths, this primordial purity which has been there since the beginning of this time. This is symbolised in the mantra, in the form of the mantra. So the mantra is a kind of journey of reintegration with one's pure depths, one's true nature. So first of all we say, O Vajrasattva Samaya. Vajrasattva Samaya, so O bond of the adamantine being. So first of all we just evoke Vajrasattva's nature. And Samaya means bond, so we have a bond with him. We have a bond with our inner nature. We are actually connected with our inner nature, if only we knew it, as it were. So we just bring that to mind. And a bond, a samaya, is like a contract from both sides, as it were. So it's saying to us, if we turn towards the possibility of the fact, the truth, that we are essentially pure, we give that essential purity an opportunity to manifest, as it were. So we do one side of it, and that inner purity does the other side of it, as it were. Or, you know, we open and Vajrasattva will kind of respond to us. Om Vajrasattva Samaya, Manupalaya, protector of the mind, or protector of our own true nature. So he protects our own true nature. So we're not in touch with it, but it's still there available to us when we turn towards it. And then we ask Vajrasattva, Vajrasattva Tano Pratishtha, stand beside me. So this is sort of stand beside me. So it's sort of closer to us, shoulder to shoulder, looking in the same direction, so stand beside me. And you know, having someone that you rely on standing beside you is a very strong experience. Even if it's an ordinary friend, it's a very strong experience. Stand beside me, be with me. And then there's an increasing emotional dimension to the relationship. We say, Dridho me bhava, be firm for me. Yeah, so let's not waver. You know, we can waver in and out, I suppose, of thinking that we are essentially pure. We are essentially pure. So Vajrasattva standing beside us, being firm for us, makes that realisation more possible. Sutosho me bhava, be contented with me, be glad for me. Suposho me bhava, be pleased for me. Anarakto me bhava, love me deeply. So there's an increasing emotional connection. And anarakto me bhava, it's very strong, love me deeply, love me passionately. So it's not weak and anemic in any sense whatsoever. And yes, we want to be loved deeply, don't we? That's probably our deepest wish, is to be loved deeply and also to be able to love. They both sort of go together, don't they? So the fact that Vajrasattva would love us deeply would be a wonderful experience. And when you love, when you really love, you give yourself, don't you? You surrender yourself. You're at one with the person or the object or the thing that you love. So we're getting closer and closer to Vajrasattva. Vajrasattva's becoming closer and closer to us. We're being interfused. We're not different. So the next line is Sarva Siddhim Me Prayacha. Grant me all perfections. Grant me all siddhis. So we're very close, and at this point, all those qualities of Vajrasattva, Vajrasattva's nature, become our qualities, our attainments, our siddhis. Sarva Karma Sutra, may purify all my karma. And as it says in Ananda's poem, let the chain of past thoughts be broken forever. So just leave behind all our skillfulness, gone. Chittam Shreya Kuruha, make me a better mind. So we wake up to Vajrasattva's mind, that the fact that we've never been impure. And then a ha 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 ho, the laughter, which again Ananda, in his poem based on the mantra, translates as the laughter of the unchained mind echoes forever. So that's really, really wonderful, isn't it? That kind of laughter. So you've kind of had this experience, you've just touched into an experience of yes, you know, there is essential purity. When you have those kind of momentary kind of glimpses into something, it does have a sense, doesn't it, of being outside time, and it's always been like that. And you think, how could you ever thought otherwise? So it's a bit like you think, how silly I was to not realise that this was the truth, and how daft of me. All you can do is laugh. You just fall around laughing. So there's a great sense of freedom at that point. And I do remember having an experience of this, again, on a meditation retreat. These are good places to go, meditation retreats, aren't they? Lots of silence, lots of intensity. And again, a retreat, I think this was Vajraloka. And we weren't allowed to read anything. We weren't supposed to take any books or read anything on those silent, intensive meditation retreats. And I'm an addictive reader, so I took a book. I took The Cult of Tara, so it wasn't as bad as it wasn't a detective novel or anything. But I thought, I have to have something, I can't not read anything, so I'll read something. The Cult of Tara is about the Tara practice. And I was, you know, the meditative mornings, complete silence. I think I was quite concentrated. And I came back after a whole morning's of meditation, and I opened the book. And read this passage, which was something about the non-difference between subject and object. And I do remember sort of getting it for a moment and falling on the bed laughing hysterically and thinking, God, that's so great and so silly that we don't know that, or whatever. And, you know, it's just, again, a moment. And then a few weeks later when I was off retreat, I was feeling a bit miserable. And I thought, well, I could find that page in The Cult of Tara. You know, it had such a positive effect on me. So I get the book, a big, thick book. Could I find that page? Could I find those words? Could I find that paragraph? No. I wasn't in the right state of mind to even find the paragraph that had, you know, sparked off that thought process. So you have to be in the right state of mind. So laughter is very, very important, particularly transcendental laughter. So I think it's good when we chant the mantra to really, you know, ha 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 ho, really go with it. Let it go, as it were. We'll see what happens when we do the puja this afternoon. So we're transcendentally laughing because we've kind of seen, experienced, even if it's only for a moment, that innate purity, that we've always been pure, that we're unsullied and unstained. And the next line is Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata, blessed all you Buddhas. So at this point, it's not just that you bless all the Buddhas, it's as though everything is Buddha mind. From that point of view, from that perspective, you see through the Buddha's eyes, and you see everything as truth. And, you know, again, we have intimations of this, don't we, when we're on retreat and we've had some sort of concentrated experience. You know, everything seems different, it seems more colourful, you know, everything smells better and the flowers are bright, and, you know, so we have those kind of experiences on different levels. And then we say, Vajrama Maimuncha, liberate me, O Vajra-like ones, Vajri Bhava, be truly Vajric, Maha Samaya Sattva, O great hero of the bond. So there's a sense of this journey towards that experience, and then a kind of understanding you're not going to be able to stay there. Not now, not at this point. That's why we chant the mantra so many times. So, again, you're asking Vajrasattva to liberate you, to be truly Vajric for you, to, you know, to honour the bond. And then you end, Ah, Hum, Fat, away with evil, away with evil. So, yes, yeah, so the mantra is a journey of integration towards a realisation of our own true nature. So because Vajrasattva is so strongly associated with purification, he's also very strongly associated with confession. And sometimes associated with the Vajrasattva visualization, recitation of the mantra, is something called the four opponent powers. So these are quite interesting as ways of looking at the whole process of confession. So first of all, you have the power of refuge. So you go for refuge. You invoke Vajrasattva as your refuge, as the embodiment of truth or reality. So in this morning session, before each session, we read a description of Vajrasattva to reenact that. So you bring Vajrasattva to mind, you bring that bond to mind. And the second power is the power of remorse. So in order to confess anything, one needs to understand the difference between skillful and unskillful, what it is that you can confess. So you reflect on your faults. You reflect on what rises up in your mind, what you would like to change. And not with any kind of guilt, not with any kind of irrational guilt, but with a wise, intelligent, objective sorting out of what needs to change. You know, it's very sincere from your heart. And then you can engage in chanting the mantra, and this is called the power of the remedy. So you chant the mantra, and while you chant the mantra, you visualize the nectar of the syllables, the hum and the Vajrasattva mantra, as this pure white light pouring down and washing you clean until you're completely filled with white light. So that's a sort of major part of the practice. And then finally, what's called the power of resolve. So at the end of a practice, you decide, you resolve not to do the unskillful actions again. It's the same as we say at the end of the compassion verse in the puja, I shall not do again. And in some senses, you know that you will do it again, but the more you say, I will not do it again, you bring awareness to what you're doing. And hopefully you can eradicate that particular habit pattern at some point. Well, you will. So that nectar coming down during the recitation of the mantra is made of light. It's very cool, it's like moonlight. It's refreshing, it's nourishing, it's cleansing, it's transforming, it's healing, it's blissful, it's purifying. So it purifies all your hindrances, obstacles and unskillfulness. And you can visualise this as kind of all that unskillfulness is, sometimes it's like a sludge or soot. So you can sort of imagine you're full of impurities, as it were, on all levels, and then the white light just kind of washes it away. So it's a very positive practice, but can have a very strong effect. You know, confession can have a very strong effect, purification can have a very strong effect, because you're purifying unskillful habits, and sometimes they're quite recalcitrant or quite deeply held, aren't they? And you know, there's a resistance. They put up resistance, as it were. So if you do a lot of Vajrasattva mantra chanting, and often people do chant 108 Vajrasattva mantras, which is quite powerful, it can have a very sort of powerful effect on them. It's not necessarily kind of easy or pleasant process purification. And Bhante talks in... when he's discussing the Sutra of Golden Light, he's talking about the white light, which is a purifying white light of the Dharma. It's as though, the golden light. The golden light enters you because of your practice and because it's always been there as well. And once it's sort of got hold of you, as it were, once you're in touch with it, he says you can't get rid of it. It won't let you go. And it kind of forces all the kind of unskillfulness out of you. He says it acts like an emetic, it kind of forces you out. So you may, doing these kind of practices, actually feel sick, you know, because you're kind of vomiting up. He says this in the text, you're vomiting up all your unskillfulness. So just gives you a sense of the power of the Vajrasattva mantra. So those of us who've done the 108 Vajrasattva mantras know that that can have a very strong effect. And you know, you can start off doing 108 Vajrasattva mantras. It takes about an hour and a half, hour and 40 minutes, so it's quite a long time to be chanting. You can have quite a momentum with the chanting. And then you can hit, enormous resistance, and you kind of want to lie down and go unconscious, or you can hardly get the words out of your mouth. It's sort of interesting what happens as you undertake that sort of practice. And you're not necessarily sort of thinking about anything that much. We're just kind of... you're trying to recite the mantra. So all sorts of things happen. It has a very, very powerful effect. Just lost my page. Anyway, yeah. But it's worth doing, even though it's... it's a strong practice. I don't know how people found it doing kind of shorter blocks, doing 21 and then 21 and then 21 and then 21. I think that's a little bit easier to kind of keep going. So sometimes when you're doing Vajrasattva practice or reciting the mantra, you also have dreams. I can remember having very sort of strange, not terribly pleasant dreams. It's a kind of whatever it is one needs to purify. You know, it's, some of which is sort of semi-conscious, isn't it? Kind of rises into consciousness. You know, sort of strange nightmares and so on. Yeah, it's all good stuff. So Vajrasattva is the embodiment of purity, and chanting this mantra is an imaginal, ritual, and non-rational way of engaging with the process of purification. So he's also called the confounder of hell, as I said in the beginning, and I suppose that's because hell, I suppose, and there's no endless hell in Buddhism, there's only a temporary hell, but hell is the accumulation of the consequences of our unskillful actions. And that can be very, very painful at times. You know, we can feel in hellish states of mind, or we can really suffer thinking about what we've done in the past. So hell is the most painful state, I suppose, we could be in. And Vajrasattva is the most positive state, or he even transcends the most positive state. So he confounds hell, all hellish states, by purifying all karma. And he's also associated with death, which is why we chant his mantra the newly dead and on Parinirvana Day, and why we have this day before Parinirvana Day. So death is the crucial situation, isn't it? And I think in any crucial situation, any kind of bardo, death is a bardo, but we experience other bardos in life. Any situation, any experience where our normal securities or the ground we're used to or the habit patterns we're used to is not present, so that can be in a meditation practice, it can be on a retreat, it can be on a solitary, it can be when we experience loss, when we're in those kind of insecure places. In a way, we're in an insecure place all the time, but we don't always realise it, do we? When we're in those insecure places, often the contents of our mind rise up. We kind of realise things about ourselves which otherwise we keep down. So death is the crucial situation. So at this point, there's a verse in the Tibetan Book of the Dead which says, may the element of earth not rise up as an enemy, may all the elements not rise up as enemies, may my unskillful states not rise up before me, may I purify my mind. So Vajrasattva is very, very crucial in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. He's there in the bardo as a positive, a symbol to open up to. So we need to, in any kind of bardo situation where unskillful memories, unskillful thoughts arise, to go for refuge to Vajrasattva, to go for refuge to our innate essential purity, to purify our minds. And we chant the Vajrasattva mantra for the newly dead to sort of help them in that process, or give them our support in that process, because as well as being a crucial situation, it's also a great opportunity to open up to reality. Sangha talks about Vajrasattva's association with death, but he doesn't actually say very much about it. He understood this, it seems, from a visionary, intuitive experience, which he often talks about if he's talking about Vajrasattva. It's quite interesting because he says he was going to visit one of his teachers in Kalimpong. He was going to visit Jamyang Khenpo Rinpoche. And Jamyang Khenpo Rinpoche asked him to wait. So when he finally got to see Jamyang Khenpo Rinpoche, he apologised and said he was chanting the Vajrasattva mantra for a lama he knew who had recently died, because Vajrasattva was associated with death. So that was the teaching. And then some time later, I think some years later actually, Bhante talks about he's in Kalimpong and he's in his hermitage, and he wakes up in the middle of the night. He says it's about 3 o'clock in the morning. And he says he wakes up, he says it's not a dream, it's not a vision. He has a sense of waking up, and by his bed he sees this enormous pit, very deep, and in that pit is someone that he knew who died, an old kind of colleague of his, and he thinks, gosh, you know, he's in trouble, he's dead and he's in this pit. And he just remembers this comment of Jamyang Khenpo Rinpoche, which says, you know, Vajrasattva, the Vajrasattva mantra is associated with death. And he thinks, well, I must chant the Vajrasattva mantra. So he chants the Vajrasattva mantra, and he says he sees the syllables of the mantra form a kind of chain, you know, kind of lovely white syllables, form a kind of rope that go down into the pit. The person, it's hard to imagine what this vision is like, the person gets hold of this rope of mantra syllables, climbs up out of the pit and disappears. One of those strange experiences. And at the same time he hears these horns blowing. There are certain caste of people in Kalimpong who at a certain point in the year they blow horns to call the dead souls. So at that point these horns go. So it's interesting. That's basically all he says about Vajrasattva's association with death. He seems to just think, and therefore, you know, it works. And from that he's encouraged us to chant the Vajrasattva mantra on Parinirvana. So there you go. one of these occasions when I was on solitary and doing a lot of sessions of 108 Vajrasattva mantras, I suddenly had an experience which also, for me, I kind of intuitively understand that Vajrasattva is associated with death. So I'm chanting the Vajrasattva mantra over and over again, and suddenly I have this little kind of meditating, I have this glimpse, this little image, that I'm standing in front of green hospital swing doors. You know the kind of doors you have in hospital. And there is a couple of people with me in green, you know, paramedic outfits, about to go through these doors. And I, you know, was visiting hospital quite a lot in those days, I think. So the doors swing open, and we go through these doors. And on the other side of the door is everybody who ever died. So that, you know, I just got a glimpse again into that experience of, Vajrasattva mantra death. So again, these things are very, very brief sometimes, but they just open something up, some understanding about the nature of Vajrasattva. So just some thoughts about Vajrasattva. Vajrasattva is purification, is purity. Vajrasattva is the compounder of hell. Vajrasattva and confession, and Vajrasattva and death. So he is a very, very positive, beautiful, mysterious and profound figure. And he encourages us to turn towards that innate purity, which is there whether we turn towards it or don't, whether we realise it or not, whether we know about it or not. But he encourages us to turn towards our innate purity, our Vajrasattva nature, by reflecting upon him and by chanting his mantra, so that we too can wake up to the fact that we've never, in our deepest nature, been impure. We've always been pure.